Council, you may proceed. Do you have the microphone? Okay, good. Thank you. We're having sound difficulties, so if we interrupt you, just we're going to try our best to make this work.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Chief Justice Abramson and Justices of the Court. My name is Stan Riffle, and I'm pleased to represent the town of Delafield in this important matter. I would intend to address the substantive matters during my chief time and would likely reserve the procedural arguments during rebuttal, those arguments being the ones raised by Mr. Hammes in his response brief. I believe this extremely interesting case is here because the Court of Appeals, and I gather you all are intrigued by the issue that was labeled by the Court of Appeals as the two kick at the cat conundrum that is created by the result of the Court of Appeals decision. And that is whether a Forest County case mandates the opportunity for a hearing on the equities before the circuit court under the facts of this case. The chief concern regarding the potential remand for a Forest County type of hearing is the possibility of the judgment of the certiorari court to ultimately, and that judgment being that the raising condition, which was approved by that court, which was part and parcel of the variance that was granted to the Winkelmans, may be overturned by a second court sitting to handle the equitable hearing. A sub-concern, I think, that's raised, and this is one that is in line with Justice Bradley's concurrence in the Forest County case, is whether or not this result, assuming that on the hearing of the equities, a trial court were to conclude that the second residence should remain, could result in the purchase of a variance, something that was warned against in the Forest County case in that concurrence. There are two reasons why, in our view, a second kick at the cat in this instance is neither authorized by Forest County and the Lake Bluff decision that followed along for 6223 purposes, nor is it warranted in this instance. And those reasons are that there's a distinction between enforcement proceedings under 6223 sub 8 of the Wisconsin statutes and the statutory provisions dealing with variance proceedings under 6223 7E. The second reason is based upon res judicata and claim preclusion rationale that we set forth in our brief. The instances involving the Good and Lake Bluff cases and a 6223 sub 8 review were such that it was the initial venture into the court that gave rise to the opportunity for the folks that were under the purview of the county and city action in the respective cases to deal with an illegal structure. In both those instances, we're dealing with an illegal structure as opposed to a legal non-conforming structure, and I think it's a distinction with a difference that the legislature dealt with in specifically putting together a statutory scheme as to how you handle an appeal of a variance under 6223 sub 7E. In our case, in contrast to the Forest County / Lake Bluff cases, we have an instance of a legal nonconforming structure that was the subject of a variance request before the Zoning Board of Appeals of the town of Delafield. The request being granted so as to allow the expansion of one of the structures in turn for the condition requiring the second nonconforming structure to be eliminated, certainly in conformity with the general thoughts as to how we ought to be dealing with legal nonconforming structures, that they ought to be ultimately eliminated. And under 6223
7E10, Counselor, could I stop you for just a minute?
Absolutely.
One of your major premises is, as you're just relating to us, that this is a legal nonconforming structure, and you follow that by saying they all ought to be eliminated. Is that latter hookup necessary to our decision?
No, I don't believe it is, and I don't believe I really addressed it too much in the briefs. I think it's parenthetical, though, that we all should have that in mind.
Well, you know, you should have it in mind, but I guess one of the things that concerns me is that, you know, zoning ordinances, you ask us to apply to the facts of this case, which, of course, we have to do, but then smart lawyers like you will just apply them to all sorts of cases. So we try to look to the extent that we're able to the effects that our decisions have on other cases. And we have a lot of housing in and around Wisconsin, which may be very affordable housing. But that housing is old, often needs to have repairs done, and to do them properly, they might have to be done on legal nonconforming structures because the zoning codes keep changing as the policies of the people who are then in power deem best to operate their particular parts of our state. And so, you know, if it's necessary to our decision that we have to assume that all legal nonconforming structures eventually should be torn down, I worry a little bit about how that might be carried over into other contexts. So I guess that's what concerns me and what drives my question.
Well, fortunately, for my time and for purposes of your determination, Justice Rogenczak, it is my view that that issue is not a central issue to the issue that is before us here today.
But isn't that one of the equities in this case? They want to tear down this legal nonconforming structure, and in fact, that was the condition of the variance.
The fact of the matter is that was the condition that was given sanction, legal sanction, by the circuit court when it upheld that condition. The only issue now is whether or not a second court should be required to listen to the equitable arguments that were, in my view, already raised and dealt with by the certiorari court.
Would I ask how old are the structures in question?
I am not entirely certain, Justice Prosser. It is my understanding that they certainly are older than 1939 in light of the fact that the first zoning ordinance in the town of Delafield, to my understanding, was promulgated in 1939.
So neither one of the structures was built by the Winkleman.
That's correct, Your Honor. They were acquired sometime prior to 1991. The Winklemans resided in one of the structures for a period of time, and now, as I understand it, reside in neither of the structures. Both of them are utilized as rental housing.
Could I ask, could the town of Delafield have granted a variance without conditions?
Well, now that is an interesting question. Of course, the variance that was requested and was before the Zoning Board of Appeals was prior to your pronouncement in Kenosha County. And so that would involve, I believe, an analysis of the Snyder case and the four prongs. Well, I'm sorry, the Snyder case as it would relate to the hardship identification that would have been shown. My feeling is that they certainly could have granted it without a condition. They chose to require it as a condition, which they did routinely in an effort to try to bring properties into compliance.
But I understand you to say they could have granted the variance.
I believe that they could have.
Could Waukesha County then have resisted that and sought some sort of enforcement action for a violation of the county ordinance?
I believe Waukesha County would have had standing in light of the fact that there was concurrent jurisdiction, in my view, although that will take an analysis of the shoreland zoning provisions that were in place. It's our view that the town ordinance, as it relates to this particular property, is more restrictive than the county, such that they would have been properly before the Zoning Board of Appeals as opposed to the Waukesha County Zoning Board of Adjustment. Whether or not standing would have been conferred would have been a matter for the determination of the circuit court. My guess is the circuit court would have granted them standing and we would have dealt with it.
One of the
equities that is referenced in this record to have been brought before the certiorari court is the argument that it was necessary to have the rental of income from the rental house in order to pay the mortgage. Earlier in your argument this afternoon, you advanced that all the equitable arguments were made. We don't have the certiorari record before us. This is the enforcement action, and we have only that record. Is there anything else in the enforcement action record that sets forth what the equitable arguments were that were raised before the certiorari court?
Justice Bradley, if you heard me to say that all of the equitable arguments were made before the certiorari court, I apologize for not making myself clear. I meant to say, if I did not say it, that equitable arguments were raised before the certiorari court. The primary issue dealt with the financial hardships that were involved. It is our position, based upon the transactional view that this state has with regard to actions of this nature as well, that that at the time that the Winkelmans were before the certiorari court, they had an obligation to raise all of the equitable arguments that could have been raised at that point in time. It is our view that Forest County versus Good simply stands for the proposition that when you are in court dealing with any of the issues pertaining to the transaction, in this case, the application of that condition to raise the one structure so as to avail yourself of the opportunity to gain the benefits of the variance, you have an obligation and a duty to raise any issues in the context of that case that could be raised. Otherwise, they are waived after that judgment is entered.
Counselor, that case was just whether the variance was okay. This is an enforcement action, and they could, the county could look the other way and realize they didn't comply with the variance but not enforce it, or the county could choose to issue a fine, $1 a day, or the county could do something else. I mean, I don't see how you can expect them to raise all their equitable arguments when they don't even know what's going to happen to them. How do you respond to that?
But the town, in this case, and it's the town that was doing the enforcement, as opposed to the county.
Right.
But in this particular, and I'm sorry, Justice, in this particular case, the fact of the matter is that they did raise those issues. And once they raise equitable issues in the context of the certiorari action, do they not have an obligation to exhaust all of those arguments at that point in time? Else we have the very situation that Justice Bradley warned us about, that we may have, and in this case, you may have a circuit court years down the line gutting the effect of a valid judgment of the circuit court. Here we have a circuit court saying that the provisions of that variance are fair and reasonable under all of the circumstances, and we posit as the town that in order to come to that conclusion, you have to go through the four-pronged test that was...
But this action is because of a violation of a zoning variance, correct? It's a violation.
It's more than that.
Well, but they're not here on certiorari review of whether the zoning was properly done. They're here because enforcement is sought, and enforcement is sought based on a violation.
The enforcement is sought to enforce the terms of a variance?
Right, but they
to enforce the terms of a...
But when you have an enforcement action, it is not necessary that the, quote, terms of the ordinance are what are enforced. You could have a fine for not following them.
And we did have a fine in this case as well.
Right. So I guess I'm a little bit troubled. I see the actions as quite different. And I don't, you know, I mean, the town could simply decide they were going to look the other way, that it wasn't worth their trouble to bother with these folks. So I don't know. I mean, I don't understand how you can expect them to raise arguments to the type of enforcement they may face when they don't know if it's a raise order, they don't know if it's a fine, they don't even know if it's ever going to happen.
I would then posit to you, what do you say to the circuit court judge that listened to all of the equities, made a determination, and let's assume all of the equities are brought in, as we say they should have been, if you start and provide some of the equitable arguments and not others, I don't think that's any way to conduct judicial economies. But what do you say to that circuit court judge when that circuit court judge weighed all of these equities, made a determination under all of the circumstances, this is reasonable? 5 years later, there's an enforcement action in part on his or her order, and a second circuit court judge says, no, I listened to the same evidence, and I find 180 degrees. And I think that's the problem that we're dealing with here.
But would the second judge really have to overturn the validity of the ordinance? Wouldn't that judge perhaps just be saying, in equity, we don't think raising is an appropriate enforcement action to take?
I hate that old adage, slippery slope, but that's what we are on if we go that way.
Okay.
And so I again believe that the scheme that was set up by the legislature under 7E10 is a totally different scheme than what we're dealing with in 6223 sub 8, in that in order for the court to make a determination, and it's given broad authority, by the way, the court basically can do anything with the conditions set by the Zoning Board of Appeals. The provision of the statute says the court may reverse or affirm wholly or partly, or may modify the decision brought up for review. And so in that particular case, the court could have looked at the situation where one of these houses was to be raised, and could have listened to the equities, and could have concluded that, you know what, I'm reversing that condition 100%.
What authority, and I know the Court of Appeals said that there was none, but I advance to you, what authority is there for a cert court to sit in equity?
And I am sorry that I wasn't thinking quickly enough at the time that we were before the Court of Appeals to respond to that question. I believe that your decision in Forest County addresses squarely that issue. In Forest County, in essence, what this court said was that unless the legislature states to the contrary, specifically in the text of the statute conferring the authority on the court, that court is imbued and has all of the equitable powers that it would have under common law. That's what you said.
Show me where that says that, because it very well may say it, but I need to be educated regarding that. I thought that the law was that that when statutory cert is being used, that the same four elements that you have in common law are the same scope of review unless the statute says otherwise. Now, maybe I'm wrong in that, so just educate me.
Well, I can only tell you that I read Forest County four times in the last 48 hours, and that was what I got out of it, and it would probably take me a bit of time to come up with the specific language that I rely upon for that premise, but it is my view that if it's not explicitly stated in the text, that was, in fact, the ruling of the court. And
I'll take a look at Forest County again.
Now, with regard to res judicata and claim preclusion again, in order to get a view of what we're dealing with here, I'd like to try to homogenize the factual circumstances of the Good case with the present case. The distinction, of course, in Good and in Lake Bluff is that neither of the decisions, well, let's just deal with Good. There was a variance. There was no appeal of that variance to the circuit court. In order to homogenize and make these factual situations the same, you would take the facts of Good that a variance was denied and have Good appeal that determination to the circuit court and assume that Good argued all of the equities that was ultimately enabled to argue by your decision in that case, And the circuit court rejected and affirmed the Zoning Board of Appeals under those circumstances, then assumed that Good refused to move or raise the house in question, and the county in that case was forced to seek some type of enforcement. Now we have apples and apples. I think that this court would have looked at that situation very differently, where either there was a full or partial argument of the equities before the certiorari court, and there was no determination, there was no appeal of the determination by the circuit court denying reversal of the variance. Again, all we feel that Good stands for is the proposition that a litigant has a right to request invocation of the equitable powers of a circuit court at the appropriate time, and that appropriate time is the first time that the matter is before the circuit court.
Well, if, in the Outagamie County case, which is a little bit different here, the state failed to assert an argument about a regulation when the case was before the Board of Adjustment. And the circuit court said, you didn't raise this before the Board of Adjustment. You shouldn't be able to raise it now. And when I wrote about it, I said, I think that's right. When arguments are not made before the Board of Adjustment, and then they're made by the circuit court, it's really disrespecting the whole Board of Adjustment. It's undercutting the position. It's denying the parties the right to make a record, because certiorari is generally simply a review of the record that's been created before a previous body. I'm having some trouble with the proposition that it's completely de novo before the circuit court.
And Justice Prosser, I understand that, but I think the distinction is, well, first of all, I found nothing, and the respondent has cited you to nothing that would stand for the proposition that when you are before a trial court in under certiorari, that a litigant cannot likewise request equitable powers of the court. And as I stated, I feel that that Forest County versus Good says precisely that. That somewhat begs your question, but I feel that the circuit court, certainly in terms of its analysis of the variance, is restricted to the record on certiorari. However, there's nothing that would stop the litigants to seek justice before the circuit court on the equitable arguments. And again, I feel that Forest County stands for the sole proposition that you have a right to invoke those equitable powers and seek those equitable powers. It just seems to me that the most judicious way to do that is to require that to happen at the initial time that the litigants are before the court. And if this court makes that determination, it will be a very clear pronouncement for all of us practicing in this area, such that we know the rules in that regard.
One of the things that concerns me is, you know, this is, we have cert actions in all different areas of law, not just this. And it, I think, is a maxim of certiorari review that the scope of cert review is limited. It's limited to the record unless the statute provides otherwise. But you're advancing the premise, and Justice Prosser is responding to it, as I guess I am, the premise that cert review now is not tied to the record. Forget what in statutory authority. You're not pointing to any statutory authority, but you're advancing the premise that cert review is not tied to the record, that cert review in any context can entertain equitable considerations in any context, huh?
Well, under this particular case, under the provisions of 6237, 6223, 7010, I believe, there is specific provision that the court can take additional testimony if the court sees fit to do that.
That's right. That doesn't specifically, I mean, you can make an argument, it's unclear what it means by take additional testimony. And so you can make an argument in there. But that argument then that you make requires you to go from can take additional testimony to can entertain any equitable argument that the parties desire to advance, even though it might be new issues, not raised below. I mean, that's a bit of a leap. I'm not sure that we have interpreted that phrase, but I am confident we have not yet interpreted that phrase to advance what you're saying.
Well, the fact of the matter is, in this case, it was, in fact, done. And so that's what we are dealing with. Those are the facts of this case. The issues were raised. The issues were dispensed with by the circuit court. And the issue that must be resolved here is whether or not a new circuit court should listen to the same and additional arguments in that regard and render an opinion. I see that my warning light's on, unless there are any other questions.
You have until your red light's on, sir.
I understand. I'd like to reserve a little time.
I sense a real hostility between the town and these property owners. Is there something really offensive about these buildings? Are they eyesores? What is it?
I think I don't believe that there's any animosity. There's an attempt of the town to follow the requirements of law, but most appropriately, the way to clue you in, there was during the time that this was before the court on certiorari, the town extended an offer of the Winkelmans to revert the one structure back to the manner which it was before the variance was granted, and then they would have dismissed the action. The reply from counsel for the Winkelmans was, no, we'll take our chances in court. And that's what I think is the genesis of what you are hearing.
They argue estoppel here. They took the permit, they agreed to the condition, and now they are backing off.
I don't think, Your Honor, with all due respect, that we could stand here and argue estoppel. They availed themselves of their statutory review on certiorari. They refused to comply, and now we are in some type of mode to try to bring some effect to that circuit court order. Perhaps this court sees it differently. I don't see that argument.
They didn't appeal one of these.
They did not appeal the determination of the circuit court on the certiorari review.
May I try to get the facts correct? The town was asked for a building permit.
True.
It granted the building permit.
True.
The Winkelmans began to proceed under that building permit.
True.
They spent money under the building permit.
That's a fact.
And the town assessed the improvements at $46,500.
Ultimately, but it in between, a stop work order was issued by the new building inspector, who recognized that there was a violation of the code. Sometime after the work progressed, and I think prior to the time it was finished.
The inference I'm drawing is that they must have spent quite a bit of money if the improvements were assessed at $46,500.
I don't believe that the improvements amounted to anywhere near that amount, but perhaps that is a question. The improvements themselves, the entire structure, perhaps, but what was involved was a minor expansion of one room and I believe a deck. Not $46,000, I do not believe, but I'm simply not in a position to give that information, Justice Prosser.
Well, then maybe I'm misreading this, but they spent the money. Did they complete the work?
Yes, they completed the work in conjunction with the grant of the variance. Then they appealed that condition of the variance, and of course we know the rest of the history.
Are you saying that an offer was made that if they went back to what they were before?
Yes, sir.
So, I'll ask.
Is that in the record?
It's in the certiorari record. It's not in the record before this court. It would be certainly something that would be argued if we are back in front of a court on an equitable hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, and we'll now hear from James W. Hams. Is it Hams or Hamas?
Thomas, representing Eric and Christine Winkleman.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. My name is James Hammes. I represent the Winklemans in this case. As a follow-up, Justice Wilcox, to that last question, Winklemans hotly dispute the fact that there was an offer made to them to put the property back in the same condition, and that's one of the issues that was intended to be argued if this in the equitable proceedings at the trial court. I guess I would start off by
let me just follow up. I hate to ask questions before you get started, right. But as long as you were responding to a question I didn't ask.
That's what I assume.
My question was this. Basically, your client got a variance, and then they remodeled.
They remodeled, and then they got the variance.
Okay.
They began remodeling. They were stopped. They applied for the variance. They completed it.
Well, then that'll fit in. They were remodeling. They stopped. They were stopped, and then they got a variance. And the variance said, all right, here's the deal. You go ahead and remodel. And then after 3 years, you're only going to have one property. You're not going to use that one. You're going to raise the property. You're not going to use it. It's gone. Didn't they then rely on the variance? Didn't your clients rely on that? And that's why they went. Because they did stop.
They stopped. There was a stop work order issue.
Right.
They stopped. The variance.
Then they got a variance.
Yes.
And then they went ahead and remodeled.
Yes.
And the agreement was, in the variance, you remodel, and then you've got 3 years, and then you don't have this house anymore, right?
That's correct.
All right. Weren't they, isn't that, when we talked about estoppel and reliance in the contract, but basically didn't they rely on that? Isn't that the issue?
They acted after the variance was granted. And if you want to characterize that as estoppel, I'm certain the court could do that. But the point I would make to you is this.
But your opposing counsel was asked that. That's why I just want to.
Okay. I guess the question I would raise is this, and it goes back to the equities of this thing. But for the building permit having been issued in the first place and the remodeling being substantially undertaken before they were ever told they needed a variance, if they were told they needed a variance before they did all of this, would they have applied, would they, and the condition was imposed, they might not have done it. Now they're in the middle of remodeling, and a condition is imposed.
How far in the model remodeling were you when the stop order came?
The roof had, which was the enlargement in this case, was the roof line was raised. That had been completed. It was all tarped. About 6 months it stood dormant. Winkleman was doing this on his own. He didn't have a contractor. Then he started finishing the project, and that's when it stopped. Percentage-wise, I don't know, but substantial. More than 50%.
Now, didn't he object to this condition?
Yes.
And didn't he take it to court?
Yes.
And he didn't appeal?
No.
So isn't that the rule of the case?
No.
Why not?
Because that is the rule of the case as far as the issue is whether or not the Board of Zoning Appeals, the condition they imposed was reasonable for that variance. But let me pose this question.
That's the rule of law in the case.
As far as the certiorari proceeding is concerned.
Okay.
But let me pose this question to you. If the trial judge in that case had said, I believe that the condition is, I cannot find that the condition is unreasonable. This is a certiorari proceeding. However, I don't think in equity think it's fair. Therefore, I'm not going to enforce it. The town will be up here arguing to you. The trial court has no authority arguing equities in a certiorari proceeding.
I'd say the same thing to the town. They should have appealed. I mean, now, which case is this? The fourth case on this case?
Second. Well, it's the second time we've been in court. I'm sorry, third. If I could, though, let me raise this question to the court. I raise it in my brief, and I think it's an issue that requires the court's serious consideration, and that's the subject matter jurisdiction argument I've raised, which is never waived. Now, this is an enforcement action, and if you look at the complaint that's filed in this case, the town says, in its complaint, it argues, you applied for a variance. A variance was granted subject to conditions. You didn't comply with the conditions. The continued use of your property without complying those conditions violates our ordinance. It's a nuisance, and we want to rip the property down. So the premise, you know, but you, the underlying judgment is the basis. The underlying order of the Board of Zoning Appeals is the basis for this entire proceeding. In O'Connell versus Board of Education, which I argued in front of this court back in 1978, this court said that in a declaratory judgment action, if you don't serve the Attorney General, there is no subject matter jurisdiction. At page 735 of that decision, you stated, because declaratory judgment action is a creature of statute, this requirement must be strictly complied with in order to vest subject matter jurisdiction in the courts. Zoning ordinances in the state of Wisconsin are purely statutory. But for Chapter 59, 60, 61, and 62, counties, towns, villages, and cities could not adopt zoning ordinances. You have to comply with the zoning ordinance. Indeed, if you look at Section 6223 sub 8, it says that you can bring an enforcement action for a regulation adopted pursuant to these statutes. If we have an ordinance here that isn't adopted pursuant to that statute or the scope doesn't apply, there could have been no jurisdiction back in the Zoning Board of Appeals, and that defect flows all the way through all of these court proceedings. 59962, as I pointed out to the court in my brief, says that the county is required to adopt zoning ordinances on shorelands and unincorporated areas. It further says that if there is an existing town ordinance, that remains in effect to the extent it's more restrictive but not otherwise. In 1969, the town had an ordinance in effect. In 1970, the county adopted a zoning ordinance. It covers the same property. And again, if you look at 59962, it says if the ordinance covers the same shorelands, which it does, we have two competing ordinances here. Which one applies?
Can't they both apply?
No.
They both, why not?
Well, because
why can't they both apply?
I'm sorry. Because the statute says if you have ordinances governing the same shorelands,
yeah,
then the town's ordinance remains enforceable only to the extent it's more restrictive.
You don't think you can enforce them both at the same time, that you can have concurrent jurisdiction over this land, and that the county and the town could decide and have the same amount of restrictions in either one or the other enforce that same restriction?
Well, I don't think there would be any purpose to the provision in the ordinance then that would limit the application to the extent the town ordinance was more restrictive. Why even put that in the statute?
Well, because they couldn't make it more liberal. If the county enacted shoreland zoning that required a setback of 26, say 75 feet, the town couldn't come in and say, oh no, you can build your house 26 feet from a lake. I mean, that's, to me, one answer to your question.
Well, I would follow up by, if you look at the next section of the statute in 59962, it deals with the annexation of lands from unincorporated areas into cities and villages. And in that case, it says the county ordinance continues to apply until the town or city has adopted an ordinance which is more restrictive than the town or city ordinance applies. I think if you look at the scheme of it, the clear intent is that you be subject to only one zoning jurisdiction. And I'm, you know, frankly, I mean, I can't think of another situation where someone is subject to zoning ordinances on the same piece of property where it's all located in one municipality, where you have more than one zoning ordinance. I think the intent here was to limit the application of the town ordinance, and I think that's what the statute clearly says, and it continues to apply only if it's more restrictive.
Is your argument, I guess I'm trying to clarify what your jurisdictional argument is here. Is it that the court lacks jurisdiction because circuit courts have subject matter jurisdiction over everything, or courts of general jurisdiction, or is it that the zoning board lacked jurisdiction to require a variance in this situation and to issue one that contained this condition, which it's now seeking to enforce?
Okay.
Because if your argument goes to the jurisdiction of the zoning board, then you should have been making that argument in your certiorari action, because that's one of the prongs of certiorari review.
That's right. It could have been raised in the certiorari action, and it wasn't. Okay? Why it wasn't raised, I don't know. I wasn't involved in the proceeding at that point. But I think
you're dealing with the subject matter jurisdiction of the Board of Zoning, then.
I'm dealing with both. I think that the Board of Zoning Appeals didn't have subject matter jurisdiction, but I also think if we follow the O'Connell decision, which says that if the subject matter of the jurisdiction is based upon the requirements of a statute, the requirement here of the statute would be the enactment of a zoning ordinance that applies to this property.
But that goes to the jurisdiction of the board or the town, not the court's jurisdiction. I think the case law that you're citing on this pertains to where there is a statutory condition on the jurisdiction of the court. Isn't that right? And we don't have that here.
Well,
your argument goes to the jurisdiction of the board to issue this conditional variance, as I understand it, not any statutory condition on the jurisdiction of the court. The court is general jurisdiction and specifically is authorized to hear an enforcement action.
Well, I recognize the general jurisdiction of the court, but I go back to what this court said in O'Connell. I mean, if that's the case, then why in O'Connell didn't you say the court has subject matter jurisdiction of declaratory judgment actions, but the failure to serve the Attorney General deprives the court of competence?
Well, there are requirements for a court to exercise jurisdiction. Start out with the premise that you have general jurisdiction. But if there's a statute that says to have jurisdiction, you've got to serve parties, that is a prerequisite to the court exercising its jurisdiction. It's a statutory provision, and it binds the court. And that's what that does. Now, if that's so the question is, what is the statutory provision here that you're relying on that says the court doesn't have jurisdiction?
6223 sub 8.
What does it say?
Says that you can bring an enforcement action to enforce. It's on page 6 of my brief, I quote it. To enforce, provides that any building erected, constructed, or reconstructed in violation of this section or regulations adopted pursuant thereto shall be an unlawful structure. So you need a regulation, a zoning ordinance that is adopted pursuant to the authorization granted by one of the enabling statutes.
That's right. And so then you go to court and you argue that the board didn't have authority here or it violated the law. That's two of the four issues.
Yes.
On cert.
Right.
But the court retains jurisdiction to decide whether or not there has been a valid regulation and a valid ruling. That's where, I mean, we're trying to understand the argument.
Okay, I can appreciate that. But assuming limited to the issue of whether or not the Board of Zoning Appeals had jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, because their enforcement action is premised upon that decision. And if you look at these statutes, the town's ordinance, section 17.19 sub A, says that no expansion or enlargement of a nonconforming structure is permitted, and that's on page, it's in the appendix of my brief, on page 117 and 118, says no expansion or enlargement is permitted unless the plans for such improvements are approved by the Board of Zoning Appeals.
So none at all are permitted. The homeowner can't do anything unless, is that right?
That's
the ordinance?
That's what the ordinance says. Right. Now,
why isn't that more restrictive than the county code section, which requires the, and I'm talking about 3.15 sub 2 sub A sub 1, which indicates that no structure shall be modernized, expanded, or enlarged except in conformity with the regulations if such total repairs exceed 50% of the current fair market value. So under the county, if it's less than 50%, you can go and do what you want to do. You don't have to ask permission.
Correct.
But more restrictive, it seems to me, is the town.
No, because
you have to ask permission every time, regardless if it's over or under 50%.
No, because the county ordinance, as you said, provides that you can enlarge or expand up to 50%. The enlargement or expansion of the principal residence in this case exceeded 50% of the fair market value. Well, therefore, a variance was required from the county ordinance. And so the towns, or if you have an expansion or enlargement where it is less than 50% of the fair market value, you do not need a variance from the county. But once you get to that 50% rule, the county's ordinance is now as restrictive, if not more, it's as restrictive as the town's.
Talking about them as kind of the ordinance, not on the words, but as applied, whether it's more restrictive. Because clearly on the words of the two ordinances, the town's ordinance is more restrictive because anytime you want to do anything, you have to ask permission.
You're correct. I agree with that. I mean, obviously, you're correct. I agree. As applied to the facts of this case, though, and that's the question Justice Prosser brought up, if you look at the decision which is appended to the appendix, there was $46,000 in improvements on the property according to the tax bill. I'm sorry. So on page 103 of the appendix. What the Board of Appeals did in this case is they went to that 50% rule as well. And they said the tax roll shows $46,500 of improvements. That's assessment ratio is 71.88%. Therefore, the fair market value of the improvements on both structures is $64,700. If we divide that equally between the two structures, we end up with $32,350 per structure. The improvements on the house is $18,699, which is more than 50%.
Let me get the facts right in this case, because it seems like what's being argued doesn't mesh with my understanding of the very appendix that you're referring to, for instance, Appendix 102, 103, and 104. So help me with this, if you will.
Yes.
As I read this determination of the board's hearing and their finding of facts, they indicate, of course, you've got the main house and the rental house. And as I understand the facts according to this, both houses were non-conforming and both houses were the subject of a building permit. Then there was a stop work order. At that time, the main house had almost 13,000 of work done, and the rental house had 2,200 of work done. I'm looking now at Appendix 102.
Yes.
And as I read this order on Appendix 104, the variance that was granted with the condition was that the work on the main house could be completed.
Yes.
And apparently the work on the rental was it, no more.
It was already completed.
It was already completed. So it was the 2,000, and that totaled $2,200. And it was that rental unit that had to be raised. And it is the original home that the variance was allowed on for the completion of the work being done. Am I correct on those facts?
Yes, except that, as you pointed out, they were both non-conforming structures, so the town viewed it, I understand anyway, as being a variance that applied to both structures.
Where does that say that in the order? It says, I'm looking at 104.
It doesn't.
The variance is granted to complete, and I'm looking at under order and determination number one, the variance is granted, to complete the expanded second story and construct the 12 by 14 deck at the rear of the house, and that's the main house. So how can you say unless there's some other order that I don't know about.
No, that is it. That is it. But if I can finish my thought for you on this subject matter jurisdiction issue. My assertion to this court is that when a county adopts a shoreland ordinance, the town ordinance is not a matter of concurrent jurisdiction. The town ordinance remains in effect, as the statute says, only to the extent of the greater restrictions. On the facts of this case, because the improvements to that main house for which the variance was granted exceeded 50%, the county's ordinance is as restrictive as the town's. Therefore, the town's ordinance didn't apply in the first place. The variance in this case should have been made, the application should have been made to the county, not to the town. Now, if my analysis is correct, the enforcement action is premised on the order of the Zoning Board of Appeals. If that doesn't stand, then the enforcement action can't stand.
If your analysis is correct, the Winkelmans don't have a valid variance, do they?
No. Their relief has to be from the county. That is correct. And it's not in the record what happened with the county, but there was some action at the county level. That's not part of this. So that's my contention with respect to that. I think it has merit. Now, the other issue, and that is the equities, the equitable arguments, I found, interesting Chief Justice Abramson's dissenting opinion in Outagamie, footnote 2, where you point out that equitable arguments are supposed to be raised in enforcement proceedings, and you point out, this is a certiorari proceeding. It's not an enforcement action. Those equitable arguments you point out are supposed to be raised there. I realize that might be dicta, but that's the way we read those
dicta,
things.
Dicta, it's in the dissent.
Still well said.
But I think it was qualified. If you read the footnote carefully, it's somewhat qualified.
I read it. But I think the sentiment is appropriate because, the problem that you have in a certiorari proceeding, and it's a practical problem as well. It's what happens in this case and in many cases. The Winkelmans go before the Board of Zoning Appeals because they're told by the building inspector they have to go. They're not represented. You end up with a record that is certainly not the complete record or the type of record that might have been prepared had they been represented. Now you go to court, and you're limited to presenting arguments based on that record. And the scope of review by the court is different. The judge is not looking at, well, is this fair, or is this right, or is this reasonable? The judge is not looking at the fact that most of this work was done because a building permit had been issued, and they're realistically in a position where they have to complete the work from a practical standpoint and accept the condition. So now when we get to the equitable arguments, maybe a trial judge isn't going to agree. Maybe a trial judge is going to say, well, you accepted this condition, you didn't put it back, which is what you should have done, I'm not going to grant equitable relief. But at least they should be entitled to make that argument. And in this case, the trial court judge was of the opinion that he could not allow them to make that argument. And I don't believe that to be the case. So since the scope of review is different, since the record is limited, the evidentiary issues are, what a Board of Zoning Appeals considers is not what a court may consider from an evidentiary standpoint. For all of those reasons, they should get their day in court as far as the equitable issues are concerned.
Counsel, what's your authority again on this argument that you advance about more restrictive and less restrictive? What statute are you relying on?
Section 59.962 of the Wisconsin statutes, and there's two relevant provisions in there. First of all, in paragraph 1M, the legislature states, to the effect that the purposes of section 281.31 and to promote public safety and general welfare, each county shall, by ordinance, all...
I'm sorry, it's 59.692,
yes.
Sub
1M. Sub 1M to start with. I mean, that's the where you start. And there it says, to effect the purposes of this statute, all counties shall, by ordinance, zone the shorelands and unincorporated areas.
Okay. Now, are we dealing with shoreland here?
Yes. Land within 1,000 feet. The Wiggleman's property, by the way, is not on the lake. There's properties on the lake, there's a road, and then they're behind that. So this has nothing to do with access to the property. It's simply within that shoreland jurisdiction. And then 59.692.2b states, if an existing town ordinance relating to shorelands is more restrictive than an ordinance later enacted under this section affecting the same shorelands, it continues as a town ordinance in all respects to the extent of the greater restriction, but not otherwise.
So you're reading into 2B as applied, then?
Yes.
If the existing town ordinance, not on the words of the ordinance itself, but you're inserting in there someplace as applied.
Applied to the facts of this case, the town's ordinance does not include restrictions that are greater than the county's.
Why do you think that statute should, the words as applied to the facts in this case, should be read into that statute rather than just looking at the words of the respective ordinances?
Well, let me tell you, Justice Bradley, this statute has bothered me greatly. Every time I read it, I get a different interpretation. I mean, I think it has to be applied to the facts of the case. All right? I mean, for example, what does the statute mean when it says if the ordinance is more restrictive? Then it goes on to say it will be enforced to the extent of the greater restrictions. Does that mean we take each little section and enforce it? Both the county's property, the county's ordinance and the town's ordinances are too. They have identical setbacks, offsets, shorelands, and so on. So do we look at the R2 classification of the two, or do we, you know, break it all the way down? I'm breaking it down as fine as it will go and say if you give the town the enforcement as to each specific provision, it still is not greater than the counties.
You're talking about Pewaukee Lake?
Yes.
Is Pewaukee Lake all in one town?
No. It's in the village of Pewaukee, town of Delafield, city of Pewaukee. One other point I'd like to make, which I didn't make earlier on this this jurisdictional issue, it relates back to this statute. It's kind of interesting. If you look at the 1969 statute, which was in effect when the county adopted its ordinance, and that's on appendix page 110. In 1969, the town's ordinance said you cannot expand or enlarge a non-conforming structure unless you get permission of the plan commission. Then the county adopted its ordinance. Then the town changed its ordinance that said you can't expand or enlarge without going to the Board of Zoning Appeals. So that the ordinance that we're operating under isn't even the ordinance which was in effect back in 1969, which raises an issue again as to the application of this statute, because 59.692 talks about existing town ordinances. They in effect repealed their requirement that you go before the Plan Commission. They did repeal it. And now they said you go to the Board of Zoning Appeals. Different body, different standard of review.
But if you're advancing this ordinance restrictive argument, why not just bump down a few more? And it says under 59.692(4)(b), variances and appeals regarding shorelands, because you're saying this is county shoreland, within a county are for the Board of Adjustment for the county. So, I mean, if that statute says what on first blush it appears to say to me, then, boy, we're really in the wrong venue. That is, there's no Board of Adjustment here, and so you have no variance.
Well, I'd be happy not to have the variance I have.
Yeah, I know, but you have that. You are in big teeth. That's big trouble.
Not Christmas yet.
That's right. I mean, you know, just a few dogs. So why aren't we dealing with the Board of Adjustment here?
Well,
variance and appeals regarding shorelands within a county are for the Board of Adjustment. And here, we don't.
Well, you know, these are issues that we, Mr. Riffle and I have argued or talked about many times.
I didn't hear that.
I said those are issues that Mr. Riffle and I, who deal with these things all the time, have talked about many times. What's happened as a practical matter is that when the town ordinance applies, they go to the town. When the county ordinance applies, they go to the county. Now, whether that practice is consistent with the statute, I guess we leave that up to the court.
What should have happened here is when the building inspector, the second guy, issued the stop work order, he should have directed you to the county for your variance? Is that what you're arguing?
I'm arguing he never should have issued a stop work order in the first place, because his stop work order was premised on the assumption that a variance was required under the town ordinance.
Well, a variance was required under either, right? Isn't that right?
Yes.
So you were going to have to go to one or the other.
That's correct.
What you're arguing, it seems to me, is that he referred you to the wrong governmental agency for the variance that was necessary for you to keep building.
That is correct. And had we gone there, perhaps the variance wouldn't have been granted. Perhaps we'd have got a different condition. Perhaps we wouldn't be here today.
Yeah, but I just raised this sub B just because it happens to be a few things down. For the great legal analysis that I just did, you've never raised or advanced that argument at all.
No,
that
I
doesn't
haven't.
Appear whatsoever in any of your briefs or arguments.
No, as I said, the practice has been that if it's town, it goes to town.
If we're dealing with the enforcement action, why isn't all this stuff too late?
Subject matter jurisdiction is always before the court.
Subject matter jurisdiction of what action? The action that we have before us? How can I deal with the subject matter jurisdiction of something that happened in 1995 that was never appealed by either of you two?
But
subject matter jurisdiction, don't I, of this?
As a practical matter, if there's a judgment where there's a want of, or there's an order where there's a want of or lack of subject matter jurisdiction, it's void. It's always subject to question. And that's why we bring it up at this late date. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That's right. Do you know 80607?
That's an inside joke. Yeah. Don't respond to that. Counsel.
I hope that wasn't directed at me, Justice Bradley.
Just in the interest of justice.
If you take this argument that Mr. Hammes is proposing here to you to its logical conclusion, you don't have subject matter jurisdiction to be listening to me right now, because that's what he is saying. We feel that certainly the legislature has conferred on the courts of the state the subject matter jurisdiction to deal with the argument that he's making, that you're not in the right place, in that you should not have been before the town, you should have been before the county. I did not brief, I did not research, and I hope it never comes up that I have to deal with whether or not there's concurrent jurisdiction, exclusive jurisdiction, or some kind of mix between the provisions of the Shoreland Ordinance and the 15 or 16 towns that I represent, because we'll be back before you to sort that out at some point in time. But the fact of the matter is, 8, 9, 10 years we've been litigating this matter, and the first time the issue came up is in the response brief to our brief in chief. We feel that it is not a matter of lack of subject matter jurisdiction. We feel that the issue was not raised at the appropriate time, and it has been waived. Finally, Justice Bradley, to address your concerns as to whether or not the certiorari action limits the trial court's jurisdiction as it would relate to entertaining other causes of action, in our brief, we cited the court's the Hanlon versus Town of Milton case, which is cited at 2000 Wisconsin 61. This stands for the proposition that a trial court may entertain other causes of action if they are so pled. A petitioner need not, but may, raise additional causes of action. Going back to my argument, if that is the case, the issues were raised. They may not have been exhaustively dealt with, but they were raised, and Judge Maudsley, in his written decision, acknowledges that. And I think it would be a miscarriage of justice for this court to allow for a situation where we don't have res judicata and claim preclusion in that regard. I believe that is the appropriate determination for this court to make. With that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Riffle. Thank you, Mr. Hummus, for your arguments today. In our third case today relating to zoning and the powers of a board of adjusters and the courts. And that concludes our arguments until later in December when we will sit again. The court is in recess today and will meet at 3:00 in the conference room.